Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 128 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, poet Cliff Yates speaks with Jeff Hattersley about changing from school hater to school teacher, his poetry collections and his love of performing, and shares some poems featuring his distinctive touch of surrealism.
Cliff Yates is a poet whose work I first became aware of when I was editing and publishing the small press literary magazine The Wide Skirt in the 1980s and 90s. I've watched him evolve over the years into that rare thing in poetry, a true original, whose work combines the realistic with the fantastic in such a way that it can only be described as Yeatsian. His collections include Henry's Clock, which received the Aldeburgh Festival's First Collection Prize in 1999, Frank Freeman's Dancing School, and Jam. Selected Poems is published as an e-book by Smith Doorstop. He was commissioned by the Poetry Society to write Jump Start, a highly regarded textbook for teaching poetry in schools, and his reputation as an inspirational creative writing tutor has led to The Guardian referring to him as the guru. I met Cliff at his home in Cheltenham on National Poetry Day. Okay, Cliff, hello.
Hi, Jeff.
Perhaps you could start by telling me something about your early life, where you were born and so on, your family background.
Okay, so I was born in Birmingham in 1952. My dad was a carpenter and joiner on the building. And my mum was a full-time mother, but before that, during the war, she was the first toolmaker in Birmingham, the first person to work a machine in the factory. And the people used to come down from the offices to see her because they couldn't believe a woman could do that kind of work. So she had a lot about her, but she was a full-time mother to us. So I was born in Birmingham, and we moved to Kidderminster when I was 10.
Was writing something you were interested in as a child or not?
I loved reading, and I had an idea that I wanted to write, but I didn't write when I was a kid at all, and I was almost discouraged at school. School was a hellish place for me. I just hated it. I was disruptive, and I must have been a nightmare to teach. So it's very ironic that I became an English teacher. The people I was at school with cannot believe that I became a teacher. It was really bad. In fact, my mum told me this story that there was a school chaplain used to know the woman over the road. And they were watching me come up the road from university. I had this long hair like Mark Bolan or something. And I was walking up, I just hitchhiked back from Swansea. And this school chaplain said to this woman, "See that lad there?" And she said, "Yeah." He said, "When he was at school, he had the highest IQ in the school. And we asked him what he wanted to be when he left school. He said he wanted to be a tramp." I have no memory of that. But I left school as soon as I could at the age of 16 and went to a printing factory. And it's only later that I went back to full-time education.
Yeah, you studied American studies, yeah?
Yeah, my first degree, English and American studies. I went down to Swansea because it was by the sea and I wanted to live by the sea. And did English and American studies. It was great. I really enjoyed it.
Did that include a literature component?
It did. I taught them into doing it so that it included more literature because I was supposed to do three disciplines for the American studies. So it's a joint honours, English and American studies. And for the American studies, I was supposed to do about three different disciplines. And I taught them into letting me do more English than anything. So I ended up doing mostly literature.
And what, you went into teaching immediately after?
No. I did various things. Immediately after Swansea, I became a teacher of transcendental meditation because I learnt to meditate when I was at Swansea. And I went straight out there to France when I finished my degree, became a teacher of TM and taught meditation for a little bit and then went back to university. So I did a lot of different things between different... I was a late developer.
Right. Is transcendental meditation something you still do?
Yeah.
On a daily basis?
Yeah, I do it for a few minutes in the morning and in the evening. It's not a religion. It's not a philosophy. It has a philosophy, but you don't have to believe in the philosophy for it in order to work. Yeah. It's just something I do. It's like sleeping, you know. I just do it, and I just find it helpful.
So how did you get into poetry then? I mean, how did you begin writing seriously?
Okay, so I was an English teacher and I was getting kids writing poems and they were writing well. But I always felt a bit of a fake because it's like, I was a typical English teacher at the time where I was trained in criticism but I wasn't trying to do anything creative. So I was getting the kids to write this stuff, and they were doing really well. And I was thinking, this doesn't feel right. And I, like the art teachers, it always got me how art teachers could always draw and paint and they'd show the kids how to do it. But English teachers, they were getting the kids to write and they wouldn't do it themselves. And I thought the art was a better way of going about things. So I deliberately sought a way of getting how to write. I worked out that the best way was to work with writers. And I was lucky in that I got involved in something in Cheshire called the Cheshire Poetry Project, where they sent us away for a week in Anglesey to do some workshops. And I did a workshop with a poet called Pete Morgan. And that workshop actually got me writing, because I wrote a poem in that workshop. And afterwards, I read it out to the group. And it just, I was really nervous. I was so nervous because the group of English teachers, and there's no one more critical, really. And I read it and it just felt really good. I just felt, I can do this. And I went back home. Three kids at the time were really, really busy with the English work and at home. And I went back home and every evening I'd do my marking and then I'd just write and write and write. And that's how I started writing.
So how old were you then? What, about 30 or younger?
I was in my 30s.
In your 30s, right?
Yeah, real late developer.
So what about writing for publication then? When did you get into trying that?
That's Ian McMillan's fault actually, because he came to our school and I was organising the visit and he said to me, "Oh, send me some poems." I sent him some poems. He was really encouraging. And he suggested send them out right to magazines. He mentioned The White Skirt, Iron, The Echo Room, Harry's Hand. And that's how I got into publication. He sent me a copy of The White Skirt and The Echo Room, I think it was, and I read them. And I just couldn't believe what was in that, what I was reading, because I'd never come across poems like that anywhere else. And that's what got me publishing. I was never a career writer. I never thought my aim is to do this and do this and do this. It just happened by fortuitously meeting the right people at the right time. We said, "Why don't you do this?" I thought, "Yeah, great idea." And I got started getting poems in magazines and then later on a pamphlet. That's how it started.
Your first collection, Henry's Clock, was published by Smith Doorstop in 1999 and received some acclaim, winning the Aldborough Festival Prize for the best first collection, I believe. Is that so?
It is, yeah. It won the Poetry Business Competition as well.
Right.
I had a pamphlet already at the time, 14 Ways to Listen to the Archers, and that became part of Henry's Clock. That really surprised me how it won those competitions. There wasn't a build-up in those days to what there is now. There wasn't a shortlist and then a big revealing of the winner. I just had a phone call from the bookshop in Aldborough saying about copies of my book, and I said, "Well, what's this for?" And I didn't even know, and then Michael Lasky phoned me up a couple of days later and said, "Oh, by the way, you might have heard from the bookshop, but in fact you won the Aldborough Prize." It was a real surprise. It was great. It's a real blast. I just didn't expect that.
Around about the same time, you also published a handbook for teaching poetry in schools called Jumpstart. How did that come about?
Jumpstart Poetry in the Secondary School. I was teaching at Marishy School, where I was the only English teacher in the secondary school, and I was getting them to write lots of poems, and they were really good. So I started entering for competitions, not to win, but just to give them another audience for their work, because there was only me reading them. I thought, these are really good poems. And they started to win everything on a regular basis. It was ridiculous.
Right.
They just won. The first time the foil thing came out, the foil competition, they swept the board, really, and the second year as well. So the Poetry Society asked me to write a book on how to do it. And that's how that came about. And they were published on the same day, those two books.
Which was more important, do you think, the Jumpstart or the Book of Poems, or were they equal in your eyes?
I enjoyed both of them. I enjoyed writing both of them very much, but they were completely different beasts. And it was like I was doing Henry's Clock for myself and I was doing Jumpstart because I was asked to do it. But actually, I really enjoyed writing Jumpstart. It was kind of much easier to write than the Book of Poems because I could come back to it every day. There was always something there. It wasn't just a blank page. So I did enjoy that.
Well, I think it's still in print and still selling, isn't it? And,
it's still in print. It's still doing okay, yeah.
And a lot of teachers regard it pretty highly, I think.
It's used a lot. A lot of writers that go into schools use it as well, which is nice.
So do you still work with children teaching workshops?
I do, yeah. I've stopped teaching English full-time now, but I still work for organisations like the Arvin Foundation.
Right.
And there's a charity called First Story that I used to work for. And I like working with kids. I find it really refreshing.
Do you do adult workshops too?
I do, yeah. I work with all kinds of people.
You'll find that that helps your own writing or not? Does it get in the way or does it not make any difference?
It did in the early days. It helped. They fed into each other. I used to write alongside the kids and I used to write poems in the classroom that would end up getting published. It was really entertaining and the kids couldn't believe what was going on. It was a very lively time. But what happened after a period of time was that my interests diverged from what I was doing in the school, so that I was in a completely different territory altogether.
So perhaps you'd like to read a poem from Henry's Clock. I thought maybe Meeting the Family, which I published in The Wide Skirt. What I liked about this poem when I first read it, and what I still like, is that it uses short statements and plain language, language that is quite deliberately flat, really. I suppose the word is deadpan. It tells what is really quite a bizarre tale in a straightforward manner, which is a device you've used time and again in your poetry. So would you like to do Meeting the Family?
Sure. Meeting the Family. He says something witty about the budgie. They smile. He's smiling so much that his cheeks ache. He crosses his legs and kicks the budgie into the fire. She screams. It is not a good start to the evening. It is not easy to make conversation with charred feathers floating about the room.
It still makes me laugh. I think I've always wanted to ask you whether or not that was based on any kind of real incident. I mean, I hope not for the budgie's sake.
It is true. It's a true story, yeah.
What, a personal thing? No. Something happened to someone else?
I was in the school and these kids were talking. I said, tell me the story. And they said, no, we're not telling you. And I said, why not? And they said, because you'll just put it in a poem. So I said, no, I won't. So they told me the story and I put it in the poem. It's exactly as they told me. And then I was with a friend of mine and I said, do you want to hear this poem I've just written? He said, yeah, go on then. And I told him. And he got really quite cross, quite angry. He said, how do you know that? That happened to me. That's my story. And it was actually his story. Somehow, someone had told somebody else, and they told me. And it happened exactly as in the poem. Complete accident. Budgie fly past his foot just as he crossed his legs. Straight in the fire.
I shouldn't laugh, really. Your second collection was Frank Freeman's Dancing School. That's a great title, by the way. Where did you get that from?
From Frank Freeman's Dancing School, a place in Kidderminster where I was growing up. At the age of 15, 1967, there was an enormous amount of activity happening around Frank Freeman's. Kidderminster was quite a depressed industrial place. Now it's becoming a post-industrial place, which it now definitely is. And Frank Freeman had a dance school there and invited all the underground bands of the time to come and play there. It was amazing. So John Peel actually drove Captain Beefheart and his magic band to Kidderminster in 1967 as part of their, in 1968 actually, as part of their tour. That place was kind of, for me, it was legendary because it made life worth living. I hated school. I hated school so much. I was so unhappy there. And the only thing that really kept me going was music. And I remember going along to Frank Freeman's on a Sunday night to the Sunday Club and the music was so loud, my ears, you know, your ears hum after a loud concert. On the Monday morning in maths, I could hardly hear a thing. And I'd just be full of the music. It was amazing.
So would you like to read a poem from Frank Freeman then now about Lighthouse?
Yes. Lighthouse. The lighthouse flickers at the end of the pier. We watch it in our red pyjamas. Actually, neither of us are wearing red pyjamas. You're wearing my blue shirt. The lighthouse flickers at the end of the pier. It's the only thing we can be sure of. Everything's uncertain since you've set a light on my record collection. I'm trying to work out an appropriate reaction, rearranging things in my head to eliminate all memory of the record collection. The lighthouse flickers on and off. Actually, it doesn't, you point out. It just appears to. You look amazing in my blue shirt. I haven't words to describe how good you look in the light from the lighthouse. Now you're here, now you're not. Maybe I should burn something of yours, you suggest. Your voice leaves me in the dark. It doesn't sound like you when I can't see you.
The lighthouse flickers on and off. Actually, it doesn't. It just appears to. Could almost be a metaphor for your poetry, in which it's full of people and things and events which appear to be one thing and then turn out to be something else. Or the realistic suddenly becomes fantastic somehow. Mm. Is that an effect that you strive for, or does it just happen?
It's the way I see the world. I think life is like that. That you think something is going on and then you find out actually it isn't, something completely different is going on all the time. And the fantastic is just below the surface. And if you alert to it, then you see it. And people are sometimes often taken aback by it. Or sometimes they don't see it. Things are never as they appear to be, in my experience. You think you've got things sussed and suddenly you realise you haven't.
Right, so that's why the humdrum so often turns strange.
Yes.
In the work of clichés.
Life is like that.
Yeah, okay. Do you enjoy reading poems in public?
I do, I love it. But sometimes it's terrible. But mostly I love it. But you know what I mean? Sometimes you read and you think, that was so terrible. But you can't really tell. That's the interesting thing. Sometimes I have a reading which I didn't think went well. People afterwards say, I really enjoyed that. I think, all right. I almost don't believe them. So it's hard thing to judge, but I do enjoy it, and some of my best memories are from readings. For example, there was one in the Albert in Huddersfield. I remember doing a reading there, and I was reading 14 Ways of Listening to the Archers, that poem which got into Henry's Clark after being the title poem of the pamphlet. And during that reading, the jukebox came on, the speakers, and people had to try and get to the bar to get them to turn it down. But nobody could open the door because someone had taken the handle off the door. So this massive door, and there were about four poets on their hands and knees trying to open this massive door with their fingernails. Stephanie Bow just amongst them, I seem to remember. And they couldn't open the door. And it was such a bizarre situation. And I never, after that, read that poem all the way through. I would always read a selection from it. I had a suspicion about it. It's always a good place to read the Albert. There are some places which are great to read at. Yeah. And if certain people are in the audience, I know I'm going to enjoy it. It's really interesting that. I do a lot of readings in schools, and I remember doing one of my first gigs in a school for a friend of mine. And because I got on with him really well, I knew he liked my stuff, there was something about it. I felt as though I could do anything on that day. And he was giving me these ridiculous situations, like the whole of year nine, so 108 kids in one room together. And I just managed to sail through it. But at other times, it just doesn't go as well. It's such a strange feeling. But on the whole, I love reading.
Yeah, I think most poets do, though. We've all had our share of what you might call traumatic or demeaning experience,
yes.
I think. You know?
The joint launch of Henry's Clock and Jumpstart Poetry in the secondary school, because I managed to finish Jumpstart in 6 months, the Poetry Society said they'd pay for a launch for both my books, wherever I wanted it, where would you like a launch? So I said, off the top of my head, Hebden Bridge, because I really like Hebden Bridge. Because of Lund Bank being there, for example, the Alvin Foundation place, which was important to me, still is. So it was set in John Lyon's studio, like a little art gallery, I think it was. And we were driving over from Skem, where I live from Skelmersdale, in the car, and it was a filthy night. It was November, and the rain was coming down. And I took the wrong motorway and tear along. And we were late. I was late for my own launch. And I was in a right mood, and I opened the door, and everyone clapped, and the room was full of all the people in the world I knew. It was absolutely amazing. It was the strangest feeling. My mother was there, my brother taking photographs with his new camera, and my cousin, people from school, people from the poetry world that I knew. It was like everyone I knew was there. It was absolutely extraordinary. And I just felt on cloud nine, and it was great. It felt a great reading, but the beginning of it was a nightmare. Getting there late for my own launch.
Yeah, your most recent collection is called Jam. It's a bit simpler than Frank Freeman's Dancing School. Jam, of course, is a word that can mean a lot of things, as in bread and jam, traffic jam, machinery which is jammed, musicians getting together and playing informally. Did you intend it to carry all these meanings?
Yes.
Is it just bread and jam?
It's... It is both. It's such a mixture of material, that book. And that's one way of describing it. And I love jam. I like blackcurrant jam. I always have done. So that is definitely in there as well. It carries those meanings. I wanted a simple title after Frank Freeman's Dancing School. I thought I'd better give it a bit of draw back a little bit. Jam. Some titles come to you at the beginning and some as the book is progressing. And that, as soon as I hit on that title, I thought, that's it.
Would you like to read a poem from Jam, maybe Life Studies?
Sure. Life Studies. I meet Tom for super sandwiches at Euston. It still looks good, his 20 quid haircut. Then I take the Hammersmith and take you to Goldhawk Road. Someone said the best moments are moments of realisation. On the bumping underground, I read Life Studies for the first time since the 70s in my old Faber Selected, 45p, signed and dated with my younger signature. O'Hara wasn't keen on Lowell, and I love O'Hara, but there's something in Lowell that I recognise. I recognise these underground stations, their names, though I've never been here before. That song by Jerry Rafferty with the unforgettable sax. I sit next to a girl who smells like a bag of crisps, or maybe I can just smell crisps. It's not a girl, I realise, it's a boy with dreadlocks eating a pear at Paddington in a pink and white scarf, camel-coloured coat, pinstripe trousers, red and black boots. Baker Street.
That takes its title, of course, from Robert Lowell. I got the impression that Lowell wasn't such an important figure for you. You know, I mean, you're reading his book for the first time in many years. And yet you also mentioned O'Hara, and I got the impression he was perhaps more of a lingering influence on you, or a source of inspiration. Is that true?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, there's a real rivalry between O'Hara and Lowell, the two strands of American poetry. And I loved Lowell when I first read him at university. Some of those poems are still, I think, really resonant and very, very good. But compared with O'Hara, he's on a completely different planet.
So do you like the New York school generally? I mean, do you like, say, Kenneth Cook and Asbury?
Yeah, very much, very much. They're really important to me when I started writing and when I came across their work for the first time, because their work is so different from everything else. The way in which, for example, in an O'Hara poem, something occurs in that poem because it actually happened, not because of any deep symbolic significance. Because you can get very tired of deep symbolic significance when you get too much of it. And there's a freedom, a feeling that anything can happen in their work, which is wonderful.
Would you like to read The Bowling Green, which is actually two poems rather than one? The first one is a fairly straightforward piece of apparent recollection, which makes no mention of the bowling green at all, in fact, until the last three words of it. And then the second one is something else again.
The Bowling Green, 1 Radford Avenue. I park the moped at the end of the entry by the door to the garden and my great-grandfather's shed and help my mother balance the table on the back of her bike. Then we wheel it home between us, laughing up the hill, not noticing the couple in the car with the children in the back. It's me and Jill, 20 years on, reversing badly into the one remaining space outside St George's Park, where me and Mike turn the tramps on in our lunch hour, sitting on the bench by the bowling green. To the bowling green. The bowling green, the shelter by the bowling green, the benches in the shelter overlooking the bowling green, the knocking of the balls from the bowling green waiting for the bus, the bowling green climbing aboard the number 7, the bowling green looking for the bus fare, searching for loose change in its deep, deep pockets, the number 7 accelerating for the hill heading out of town, the bowling green looking out of the window at the benches in the shelter. The knocking of the balls from the bowling green.
Surreal is the word that springs to mind with relation to that second piece. I think surreal is a word that's often used by reviewers, and often wrongly, to describe writing that isn't wholly realistic, because it's not really surreal either. But it does apply to some of your work, such as that piece. I mean, there's no other way to describe the image of the bowling green getting on the bus and looking for his bus fare, for instance. So how did you write something like that?
I don't really know how I wrote that. I don't really know where they come from. I certainly didn't set out to write a poem about a bowling green getting on the bus. I think I came out with the first line and the rest of it just came out like that, much like Lighthouse did. But there's something true for me about a bowling green searching for loose change in its deep, deep pockets. For me, that is exactly right. That's exactly what a bowling green would do if it got on a bus.
Right.
So there's something that feels right about that, but I could not attempt to justify it, and it's quite hard to visualise a bowling green getting on a bus. On the other hand, it's not. You couldn't paint it very easily, but in my head, I've got an image of a bowling green getting on a bus. I'm quite interested in that distinction between what you can do in a poem and get away with and what you can't do. In a painting, for example.
I would think perhaps there was a bit of Ian McMillan in there. I mean, I'm not trying to draw a cheap comparison. It's a compliment, you know. Would you say so?
I don't know. I think it's hard to for a writer to detect influences. What you can say, you can talk about the writers that have been important to you as a writer, but they're not necessarily the poets that actually find their way into your work. Do you know what I mean? For example, Tom Raworth was very, very important to me, but I'd be hard put to necessarily find something of Raworth in my poems.
You said earlier about how you did transcendental meditation. Do you think that has helped shape your poetry at all? Has it helped you develop as a writer, or has it made no difference? What would you think?
It's really hard to say because it's something that you do, and it's quite hard to imagine what it'd be like if I never did it. I think it does. It definitely has an effect, because the main thing about TM is you can't come back. I remember at the end of the school day after teaching, I'd be absolutely shattered, and I'd meditate for a few minutes, and I'd suddenly be awake again. Whereas a good friend of mine, he used to drink a few gins and lie on the floor listening to Mahler for about half an hour and then fall asleep. So it makes you more awake and more alert. So, yeah, I think it does. I think it gives you a little bit more energy, tapping into something much deeper so that you've got more to go around, really.
Right, I could do with a bit of that myself, I think. You know? Well, thanks very much, Cliff. I think we'll call it a day there, yeah?
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Jeff.
That was Cliff Yates in conversation with Jeff Hattersley. You can find out more about Cliff on his website at cliffyates.blogspot.com. That's Yates, spelt Y-A-T-E-S. And that concludes episode 128, which was recorded by Jeff Hattersley and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 129, the poet and translator Debjani Chatterjee speaks with Frances Burns about her writing work in the community and her own medical traumas and their impact on her life. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.